Greetings, everyone. This is a Sound Health Options show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning. I am so excited about this show. We are going to have one of the good guys on. I just looked up his website, Dale Carson Law. Now, a lawyer. And there he stands with this great big gun that looks to be about 3-4 feet long and this relaxing shirt, and it says, former FBI agent. And he's a lawyer, and he's going to protect us. He's like David against Goliath, but he has the tools. He's a former cop. He knows everything from both sides. He deals with criminal defense, DWIs, drugs, traffic stuff. I shouldn't put those two together, should I? Drugs and trafficking. Traffic stops. Drug deals. He is helping the little guy because there's a trend in America, and I heard Jimmy Carter say it the other day, our former president that left office in 1981, that President Carter said when he left office, there was one in 1,000 Americans in jail, and now there is 7 in 1,000 in jail. There is a problem with that, and Attorney Carson is going to tell us how to stay out of jail. So this is an incredibly important show, and it goes right along with the show that we just did a couple weeks ago on how to tell when someone is lying. Now, we've put that up on our website, thesoundhealthoptions.com, and we've put it up on Vimeo, so Vimeo.com. You can look under Sherry Edwards or Richard's Talk to Me Guy, TTAMG moniker, and you can watch that show and you can bring that into your life. We are sponsored today by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology and Sound Health, the largest alternative health center in Ohio, I think in the eastern United States. And we've recently been asked to join several other colleges. That's awesome, and teach this stuff to a lot of other people. There, we just stick a microphone in front of your face. We look at your voice, which is a holographic representation of all that you are, and we can tell what's going on. Like we did Jerry Sandusky's voice a year before he went to trial. We knew what was going on with his voice, so that's the information and the software. We're going to give you the software so you can tell who's lying and who's not. We're right now working on infertility and morning sickness, mainly because of all the things going on with Gardasil. We're going to help bring that out. We are not simultaneously broadcasting like we do every other week. Oh, well, not every other week. I'm saying that wrong. Tuesday we have a show, and we're going to be simultaneously broadcasting there. But we don't do it on the Sunday show, and the reason I'm bringing it up is we're having Helen Lobato on, and she's going to talk to us about all the lies surrounding Gardasil. So very happy to have her on, and you can watch the show. So I think that's all my beginning stuff. You probably have announcements you need to bring out too, Richard.
I'll remind everybody, this is going to be one of those shows that you're going to want to listen to again, because Dale, we were just talking backstage, and Dale and I had also talked before to prep for the show, and Dale is just filled with good information. Sometimes, no, I was going to say scary, but not really. Not really scary, just in, you know, great information about, we've had him on before a couple of times to talk about his book, Arrest Proof Yourself. And it's great, powerful, potentially life-changing information. And I know it's going to be a show you're going to want to listen to and or possibly send to your friends. And the easiest way to find it about 10 to 15 minutes after we end the show, or I end the show over here in Blog Talk Radio Land in California, You'll be able to go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and then click on the Blog Talk Archive Player tab, and the last five shows will be there, and you'll be able to listen to it there. You can also go to any of your popular podcast aggregators, players, apps, software, whatever you want to call it. Means iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts or Dogcatcher or any number of... Stitcher is a good one. It's free. And you'll be able to... let's say you do it in Stitcher. One of the reasons I like that is it's easy to pull up a podcast in Stitcher. You just go to Stitcher, sign up for a free account, and then search for Sherry Edwards, and you'll find upwards of 500 casts we've done. And you'll be able to not only listen, but you'll be able to send that on to somebody if you want. If you have a friend who you think would be interested in the information, it's really easy to pass forward, which I like about it. I use one called Pocket Cast, which is very similar, has some other benefits. But you can find all our shows in any of those. And I would advocate for people to go to blogtalkradio.com, sign up for a free account. They don't spam you. They don't do anything that we know of that's evil with your email address. And then once you've signed up, search for Sherry Edwards, and you'll be able to find all the shows there. And the great thing about doing it at Blog Talk Radio is it gives us points, which is good, moves us up in the ratings. And you'll be able to follow us and get notifications or anything that gets promoted about a show that we're going to do, automatically notified. And there's a lot of great shows at Blog Talk Radio that you can listen to for free. So that's my favorite way, is to go to Blog Talk Radio and sign up, because that gives us points. All right, that's my immediate announcement. You want to toss something in, Sherry?
Yeah, one of the things that we want to do here at the Institute, and we see clients, the ones that the doctors can't figure out, but we also like to teach people how to do this for themselves. So we have an online workstation, soundhealthportal.com, that you can join and learn to do this for free, even this one about lying. But we've got an upcoming class, I think in 2 weeks. We skip a week and then it happens. But it's 5 days, and it's for people who want to learn to teach this and who want to learn to open a bioacoustic center in their particular community. And we are offering it for an absolute rock-bottom price. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think it's $1,200. Yes, our $10,000 course is going to be offered for just expenses. This is how important this is, because we are being lied to every moment. And what brought this thought up is somebody has bought sponsorship on our show as it's rebroadcast, and it's pro vaccines, and that's not us at all. And when I wrote in to complain about this, then I'm being bombarded on my own Facebook about why I'm so stupid that I would think vaccines are not a good thing. So we are being lied to at every corner. We have a pre-vaccination risk factor software that we are giving away to communities or groups that want to see what damage has been done to their children. You know, some people can get a vaccine and it doesn't bother them. The next person that gets it ends up in a wheelchair. And we have tried repeatedly to get them to embrace what we're offering so we can test people and segregate those that are going to have some kind of problem with these vaccines, and they are not interested. So we are very interested in bringing people the truth, especially about things that are going to damage us for generations to come. That's my two cents, Richard.
That's a great two cents. I have a couple announcements. I'm trying to move away from politics, although I'll just toss out quickly. I'm looking forward to the newest Mailgate with the discovery that two of them relatives of the president have been using private email servers, and when they got the order from the I'm not sure what agency asks, says, you know, let's all hold still and do everything. The first thing they did, with an order to say don't do anything with the emails, was dump it all to a private server on in the Trump enterprises. So that's a curious reaction. So that's all I'll say about that. Yep, that's happening now. Yep. Yeah. My good news is, and wouldn't this be just an amazing, I'll say now that I think this would be an amazingly, just an amazing mind-blowing thing to happen here. Scotland bans fracking indefinitely. Period.
Right.
They had previously had it on a hold process, but they had over 65,000 people show up to a public consultation on fracking. Reportedly, 99% opposed the process. The energy minister said allowing fracking would cause long-lasting negative impacts on communities, as well as impacting Scotland's public health and the environment. Wow! Environmental effects. As a result, the moratorium, which was put in place since 2015, would continue indefinitely, he said. The decision I am announcing today means that fracking cannot and will not take place in Scotland. Wow.
We're going to get that guy who invented this thing, energy from the sun. I heard about him a few weeks ago, but he has this grid that you can put between you and the sun. It translates that into radio waves and then translates that into electricity. Wouldn't that be awesome? No coal, no fracking, no nuclear. Yeah.
Sounds very Tesla-like.
Yes, we need to get this guy on.
Yeah. And then my second one, speaking of Tesla, is that Tesla, Elon Musk, is aiding Puerto Rico, since FEMA and our administration seems to be dragging their feet, even though the Puerto Rico people are U.S. citizens. So it's a curious pile of smoldering something that's going on there. And Elon Musk is sending a boatload, perhaps literally, I don't know, but I know many of the power walls, which are the giant battery systems, to Puerto Rico, and he has sent a crew, a team from his company with the batteries, and also another team who is working on setting up solar systems in Puerto Rico. And that has further led to conversations between because he's part of the solar company, Solar City, to talk to them about the possibility of getting more solar power in Puerto Rico, which would be much faster than it would be to repair the existing system. So that's an amazing thing. That's very cool. I love that. And do you have another announcement, or Sherry, or shall I get to Dale?
I am good. I'm excited to hear about what Dale has to share with everybody.
I bet. That's always good. Dale Carson had a distinguished career in law enforcement as a Miami-Dade County police officer and as a special agent of the FBI. In the FBI, Dale served as an instructor in interrogation and sex crimes at the famed FBI Academy at Quantico. He also served as a member of the FBI Special Weapons and Tactics Team, SWAT. Dale earned his Juris Doctor degree from Florida Coastal School of Law in 2000 and has built a successful practice in criminal defense and personal injury. Dale's background in law enforcement gives him detailed knowledge with which to challenge police procedures, arrests, and evidence. Dale joins us to talk about his up-and-coming book and to remind us how to arrest-proof ourselves. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to deal with folks who are concerned about our health. That is the most critical thing in our lives these years is being healthy.
Yep. As we what did you say earlier when you and I were talking backstage about the advantage of age is that we know something? What is it we know? Besides not what
right.
we can't do, but I think there was a health thing you said as well.
Yeah, well, what the things we shouldn't do, we now recognize them because they tire us out and make us worthless. You know, exercise is the key, though. I've learned that. stuff. You exercise routinely, you'll live long and prosper, perhaps.
I think so. I think it doesn't hurt. That's for sure. You know, and so many of the cultures that people study, you know, they don't call it exercise. They just call it life. You know, they work in the field. They do things. They tend their farms. They're physically active until they fall over one day picking turnips. I'm making that part up. But I mean, in terms of, you know, you're just physically active. Now we've gotten cultured so that we're,
you know. I hear
that
if you work for Amazon in their warehouses, you walk about 20 miles a day. So maybe that's what we need to be doing.
Maybe more of that. So I have a slightly, I know we're here to talk. Dale's book, Arrest Proof Yourself, is great. I cannot suggest or advocate enough for our listeners to go out and get a copy. You can get a physical copy, or you can get it, or go get it on Kindle now. It's a really great guide, and we'll talk about some of that today. We're really here because we want to talk about what you're talking about in your new book. But I have a question that's a bigger question. In your many years of experience of law enforcement, when did things change? When and why did things change from officers being peacekeepers to law enforcers?
I think probably in the 50s things changed. I mean, realize that originally police officers were very much part of the community. I mean, they lived, there weren't cars used in law enforcement to the extent that they are today. You walked a beat and you picked up a police phone and contacted the dispatch or what would be central station, you know, once every hour to let them know where you were and what you were doing. And as a consequence, you had to be directly involved with the people on your beat. You were part of them, and oddly enough, they were part of you. So today, that has all changed. Air conditioning in cars, the fact that there are squads where you rarely know the people that you're enforcing the laws against. So in a sense, it makes it easier for law enforcement to persecute people with the enforcement of laws because you don't know who they are and you couldn't care less and you're not going to be there 6 weeks from now anyway. I mean, it is true that officers work zones and they work them for a period of time. But the bottom line is law enforcement today has nothing to do with the community that they serve. They don't typically live in that area. They live in gated communities away from the people that they enforce the laws against. They're not part of the social structure. You know, that there are really, back in the 50s, there were really great Life magazine covers. Rockwell did them. And I can remember one where there's a rather rotund police officer sitting on a stool in a drugstore fountain where they would serve Cokes and things of that nature and icy floats. And there's a little kid sitting next to him, and down on the floor is a pole with a kerchief wrapped around his belongings, and it was obvious that he's running away. And the police officer is not arresting him. The police officer simply took him to get a chocolate malt or fill in the blank, and they're chatting about maybe he did the same thing when he was younger. That changed to the circumstance that we see in the 80s and the 90s, where law enforcement begin to look dangerous. They're wearing clothing that demonstrates that they are dangerous. Now, some of it truly relates to the environment that they enforce in. You need a bulletproof vest. But I don't think that you need to look frightening and scary. Those are attires and equipment that you would have for, you know, very, very dangerous operations relating to hostages and things of that nature. You wouldn't wear that as a standard. And today, oftentimes, officers wear it as a standard. I mean, it looks pretty cool, but it's frightening to people who are uninitiated.
Well, and even to somebody who's uninitiated, I mean, I'm in my 60s, and we've talked about this before, that when I was a kid and you, you know, like in a teen, and you would be in, you know, doing some, you know, potentially bad thing. And I'm not talking about burning things down. I'm just talking about being stupid. And, you know, the officer would come up and he'd say, you know, hey, Richard, what the hell are you doing? You know, and he'd talk to you and he'd give you some grief. But when he got out of the car, you weren't frightened because he looked mean or tough. He was somebody who, as you said, was in your neighborhood or you grew up with his kids and you knew that. And you had a relationship and of some kind. He was still scary because he was a cop. But oftentimes what he'd do is throw you in the back of the car, take you home, and the worst thing he'd do is tell your mom that you were stupid. And then don't let him find you doing that again. And now, last year, I was pulled over for a taillight. This leads to a secondary question. I was pulled over for a light that sits in the back deck of my window that's a brake light. And so this officer had chosen, this was a local officer in an area where I live, and he had chosen to pull me over
Let me point it right here. That is not a requirement of the law. The only requirement of the law is that there be a red light visible from 500 feet, only one in the back of your car in Florida. So when they stop you for a taillight out, let's hear the rest of your story, but they are looking for something. They're not looking to castigate you over a busted out taillight lens.
And that's exactly what I felt, but these policemen are thuggish by nature or texture, I don't know what to call it. I mean, they look, you know, they're not like, hey, you know, friendly or affable or anything. They're aggressive by how they speak. I mean, I'm an old guy in my 60s. It's not like I'm, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and I look threatening. It's not, you know, actually at that time I was using a cane even. And so they pull me over. They give me static about that. They also, because my driver's window does not go down because the mechanism is broken and it's stupidly expensive to fix, it just doesn't go down. So that set them off. And the next thing in there are like, well, do you mind if I search, you know, look around in your car? And talk to me about my, not power, but my rights or my thing there. How do I say to the guy with the gun and the taser and the, you know, gas to, you know, shoot my eye, or, you know, whatever he wants to do, billy club. How do I have rights there? How do I stop him from doing that?
No. Absolutely. Your biggest right is in the protection of your body, right? So that's your biggest right, and that's the right that allows you to accuse other people of assaulting you if they touch you. And when you're in your car, that's an extension of you. So the bottom line, particularly in automobile stops, let's just go back a little bit and explain why traffic stops are so important to police officers. Traffic stops are important to police officers because it helps them increase the number of arrests that they make on a monthly basis, which leads to a promotion internally within the law enforcement organization. So most individuals who are street officers want to be detectives. I mean, you only have to look as far as Hollywood, the movies we watch, they're about detectives and those kinds of things and the things that they do. And so that's an important part of American culture, being a detective, not being a street officer. So the result is that they need to make plenty of arrests. Now, the only way a street officer can make arrests is to find somebody who's in possession of something illegal. And what has become the standard over the decades is that they make car stops for minor potential problems, but it gives them an excuse. And then they walk up to you, and during the traffic stop, they ask you, can I search your car? And the answer to which is no answer at all, and I'll give it to you. No charge, okay? This is so simple, and we never think about it, though we use it all the time, okay? First off, the most important thing to know is that when you're driving in a car, you're actually going somewhere. Now, that makes perfect sense, but we forget that, right? So you're going somewhere, and typically, if you're an American, you're late, right? Now, there's a key to this, and the key is you never lie to an officer. So if you're going to buy drugs, don't tell the officer, look, officer, I'm late already. I was going to buy drugs. The response should be, I was going to my work, to the grocery store. I was going to a date. I'm going to the office, whatever it is, and now I'm late, officer. So can I go, please? The other part of this is when they ask to search your car, you do the thing that happened to me when I was younger all the time. You see someone that you'd like to have a date with. You walk up and you say, hey, would you like to go to a lunch, dinner, whatever, a movie with me? And they look at you straight in the face and they say, you know, I knew your brother, and what a great guy he was. How's he doing? They never answer the question. The answer to will you go out with me is no, but they never answer the question. I mean, and that's the way we need to behave with officers. So what I say to them is, officer, I was late when you stopped me. I need to get going, and I really am late. Can I go? So you're not answering the question about can I search your car, because we're never going to surrender the right to search the car. Now, what the officer will do is frightening for a lot of people. They say, look, if I can't search your car, I'm just going to get a warrant. And the answer to that is you just look at them. You don't say, oh, okay, go get a warrant, be a wise person. You just look at them. You don't say, okay, go get a warrant, because you don't want to consent to them getting a warrant. What you want to do is just look at them and say, officer, really, I'm late. That's all you say. Now, can the officer get a warrant? It's not likely. What they may try to do is bring a narcotics dog by and have the narcotics dog alert on your car, which then gives them probable cause. Or if you've been smoking reefer in the car and you crank down the window and they smell the reefer in their car, you've got probable cause. They don't need to ask for your permission to search. But the upshot is you can never simply let them search your car. Please don't do that. Look, here's what happens when they search your car. You got a kid who's got his best friend has got ADHD, and he's got Ritalin in the car, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of the two of them drop out, and they're behind the back seat in your car. The officer pulls the back seat of your car out, looks behind it, finds the Ritalin. Guess what? You go to jail for possession of narcotics. Can you explain their presence in the car? No, hell, you don't know. Would a person lie and say if they were their controlled narcotics, would they say, I don't know where they came from? Of course they would. So you're going to jail. That's one of the key reasons you don't want them searching your car. Plus, it creates this incentive, this culture that exists with police officers that they can stop every car and search the car. And again, that's the only way they can make arrests, because they don't interface. It's not very often that a police officer driving down the street sees a burglary, an auto carjacking in progress, a shooting in progress. Those things rarely happen. But do they find narcotics? Of course. Is it a felony? Yes, it is. So they make felony arrest after felony arrest after felony arrest for narcotics. That doesn't solve the narcotics problem in the country. All it does is create a whole underclass of these, Sherry was mentioning it, the 7 people in 1,000 who are in custody for ridiculous offenses. I mean, it's what police officers do today is almost like taking out your handgun, shooting yourself in the foot and saying, I'm a good shot, aren't I? Answer, yes, you are a good shot. But you shot yourself in the foot, and it's going to create a lot of harm for you for a long time. And that's where we end up with these people in custody for possession of minor amounts of drugs. All of those kind of things end up overpopulating the jails and the prisons with people who really are no different than most of the people you live around in your neighborhood. They just happen to be caught.
Mm-hmm. And is it sort of a background to where we're going Could you talk about the difference of old school training officers versus the style of the, I don't know, style is the best thing I can come up with. You'll have a much better word, I'm certain. But, you know, talk about training officers of old school versus today.
Yeah, I could do that. And it's really fascinating. When I had training officers, first off, police officers typically go through the academy, the police academy. There have been many movies about it. They're a little bit different than what actually happens. But police academies teach you the nuts and bolts of law enforcement. They try to teach you some psychology. You know, there are actually college credit courses that you take. But what happens after we got out of the academy is you got with a riding officer. And during that course, and that became your FTO, your field training officer, that officer would say to you, Dale, you heard all this stuff that they talked about. You just forget all that. Here's the way we really do this. Okay. And typically, it was a much more big-hearted enforcement technique. I mean, there were people that you just didn't put in jail. I mean, we didn't put over-the-road truck drivers in jail. We didn't put just idiots wandering around doing stupid things in jail. Why waste your energy with that? So there was a culture at that point where you didn't simply arrest everybody for no matter what the charge was. But that changed over the decades. And now field training officers are concerned that if they don't teach what the police academy teaches, then they will be dimed out, meaning their trainees will call the head of the sheriff's department and say, Officer Carson's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He told me I ought to do this instead of what you told me to do in the police academy. So the result is that the empowerment of these younger officers and this concern about political correctness and other aspects of law enforcement have become so embedded in the process now that we are very closely mirroring exactly the behavior that the academies want us to mirror. And that's resulting in more arrests than ever before. And it's not looking at the people as individuals that are in our target sites for being arrested. It's looking at them as statistical accomplishments. And again, police officers are remote from most of the population. I don't think people fully understand it, but I never got invited to parties in my community. When I was a police officer in Miami, when I was an FBI agent in Atlanta, you know, nobody said, hey, let's invite the FBI agent or the police officer down the street. He can come to our party. No, there's a very natural restriction that people go through when processing whether to engage law enforcement personnel in their personal lives. And wisely, many of them don't. And I would say the vast majority don't. So the result is that police officers, and we did this in Miami, call the people that we police, we call them the other people. They're not called maligning names or racist names. They're just, quite frankly, the other people. They are different from us. They are the other people. We have the enforcement power. They have nothing, and they are that's the batch of fish we pull the criminals out of.
Mm. I have a question as a female was stopped by a cop in the middle of nowhere. What would happen if I just said, well, I'm really late. I need to go. I'm getting in my car. I need to get to my destination. Either arrest me or let me go. And you just get in and go. What would happen?
Well, I think, Sherry, you never want to give somebody that power of an option. What you want to do is simply this. You want to get on the phone, and let's just presume that you got cell service. First off, it's dark at night. Simply because there's a blue or red light behind you doesn't necessarily mean it's a police officer. So the first thing you should be doing is you can turn on your flashers and you can drive to a well-lit parking lot or a restaurant or a filling station. And that's one thing you can do. Just drive under the speed limit, but drive to that location. The next thing you can do is get on the cell phone and dial 911. Get a hold of the dispatch and say, hey, look, I'm on wherever you are driving. I'm on Eldon Highway, and there's someone following me. I think it may be a police officer, but I'm concerned. I don't know whether it's a police officer or not. All of those calls are recorded. So later they're not going to be able to accuse you of fleeing or trying to avoid getting stopped. The reason chases happen is because typically the people in the cars have something to hide: narcotics, drugs, handguns, a body in the trunk, whatever it is. That's the presumed reason. But candidly, in a circumstance that you're describing, you want to get in contact with 911. There's nothing to stop you from doing that, Sherry.
Okay, this is a real situation that happened. We were renting property from a local college, and I came out of the college property onto the normal streets, and within a mile or so, the college cops stopped me, each coming up on one side of my car, guns drawn.
Oh,
and
my.
I just punched the button, and my husband was listening, and they're trying to make me get out of the car and do this and do this. I said, you're not even on college property. I will drive to the local police station. And they said, you're not going anywhere. And my husband spoke up, and boy, they backed off in a hurry. Ends up, it was because I had made a complaint about one of them to the local college about they were in our beside our property, and they had no business to be there. Nobody had called them, but they were there in the middle of the night rummaging through things, and we had video of it. So that's what it ended up being. They weren't punished, but they sure scared the silly out of me.
Of course. And this is where a lot of people have trouble with law enforcement. So what if they had said, you reached for a gun? They thought you were reaching for a gun. They thought you were a danger, and they shot you. I mean, those are the things that people are fearful of today with law enforcement. And a lot of it, candidly, has to do with the lack of connection between law enforcement and the communities that they enforce. You know, we learned this in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we began to protect them with our hearts and our minds and our souls, so to speak. We became part of their culture. And sadly, that has not happened in America when we talk about the inner cities, where law enforcement are concerned about their own welfare when they're involved in addressing issues that commonly occur in those neighborhoods. The shootings, the auto thefts, the burglaries, all of those kind of things are dangerous environments. And so one of the concerns that law enforcement has is just their own survival in a way that they didn't experience 30, 40 years ago. It was there, but it was much more infrequent than it is today. I mean, when we have police officers being ambushed, I mean, they're even more. My point in saying this is that they are more on edge. They are more subject to act out in negative ways toward us as civilians. And it's something to really be aware of.
Well, it really scared me because they stopped me where there was no lights. They pulled me off in almost into a field, and if I hadn't had my cell phone, I think there would have been some real damage. So your advice and having people just flip up and call 911, I think that's incredibly wonderful.
Right. Well, we have problems in Florida with people pretending to be police officers, and they typically target women, and they... So we have, the law enforcement community, at least in Florida and Northeast Florida, have promoted the thought that if you're concerned, call 911, turn on your flashers, and drive slowly to a well-lit area. And if you do that, a bad guy is going to move away from you. They're going to stop and go someplace else. They're not going to follow you into a well-lit area. And, candidly, if it is some bad person attempting to abduct or injure you, the police response, because you've made the 911 call, will be almost immediate.
Mm-hmm. That 911 trick is brilliant. That's great. Just the idea of you get stopped and, you know, if you're suspicious, to dial 911 up and have it going in the background immediately, that's a great idea.
The other good point about that is it's recorded in Florida, at least. It's a two-party consent state. So you can't just record conversations. You see a lot of people recording video and audio of police officers in a stop. You know, technically, that's probably a violation because the other party hasn't agreed to be recorded. Now, if you have a video camera today, you're holding up your phone and they can see that it's recording, that's something different because they're on notice. But with a 911 call, the calls are recorded. So typically, everything that's said is going to be heard. The dispatcher's going to hear it. And if the officers are not behaving themselves, the dispatcher's going to know it. So you have a body of evidence that's real time and can be used to help you should things turn south or go sideways. I don't know why they always say go south, because it's nice sometimes you're in the south. But when they go sideways or pear-shaped, as they call it, you'll have that recording. And you can use it in that context to protect yourself. Now, if you're a misbehaving sort, you don't want to get on 911 because your voice and your conduct can be recorded. And that could be a negative thing if you are a bad person.
Oh, this is a good question from the audience. What do you do if you do have dope on you or in your car? Can they search your car or your person? I mean, what is the trigger point where they are enabled? You don't always have to give permission, but tipping point where they can legally search you? What do you have to do to make that happen?
And that is the great question. And here's the answer. First off, don't smoke dope in your car. You know, but a lot of people do. So if you roll down your window and the officer's standing right next to the car and he smells reefer, he has probable cause to arrest you. If he arrests you, he has probable cause, or not probable cause, he probably has the authorization to search your car. You've committed a criminal act, which is smoking reefer for possession. He's going to search your car. And a lot of times people have more than just the marijuana in their car. They got a handgun. You know, they've got other drugs. They've got stolen property. I mean, a lot of people, the only safe place to lock up things that they own is not in their house where they're living in an apartment with three other people. It's in their car. So you don't want to smoke dope because that gives the officer probable cause to search. Also, if you've got a gun laying on the back floorboard of the car, even though it's probably lawful to have a handgun or a long gun in the back of your car, it's going to result in an increased scrutiny. So let me change the topic from gun to contraband, or let's just say some stolen item, you know, in the back of your car, and they can see it from where they're standing. The calculation is, does the officer have a right to be where they are? Okay, well, if they're standing outside your car and you're in a traffic stop, they have a right to be where they are. They look in the car and they find something that indicates criminal conduct, they can seize that item and then search your car. So the key to all of this is, A, don't carry stuff in your car that will allow police officers to search. And B, never consent to a search. The new law, there's a new federal law which says that you can only, in a traffic stop, you can only be detained for the length of time it takes to write the ticket, about 15 or 20 minutes, no more. So if they make you wait there for 30 minutes while the dog comes, or they just kind of harass you for 45 minutes or an hour, which actually happens, a good lawyer can probably have that arrest thrown out because they were only allowed to be there for as long and detain you for as long as it takes to issue the traffic citation.
Well, that's good to know. I'm going to write that down. Email my friends. Did you know? That's a great one.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to go ahead.
No, you. Sorry.
Okay. That's all right. I want to move us toward talking about, there's so many questions that I want to talk about, but I really want to talk about what you're focusing on in your new book that you're working on, where you're really looking at, a big picture of trying to get the law enforcement system to refocus the management to where become more effective, more productive. And what are you up to?
Well, the new book really addresses a core issue. The core issue is that most law enforcement officers want to help people and be public servants. They don't just want to be out there shooting at bad guys and putting, you know, everybody in jail that they can. They understand, because they are part of the community, that we all want to live in a better, safer, happier environment. And they, law enforcement, can be part of that solution instead of being part of the problem. The problem is that managers in law enforcement are still hooked into this belief that the only way to have a crime-free existence in a community is to put all the criminals in jail. Well, I will tell you, I think all of us are criminals. We all do stuff that we shouldn't do. It is the human condition that we do stuff that we realize later we're embarrassed to have done, and that we're probably not really good people if we continue to behave that way. And I'm not saying that everything we do is criminal. What I'm saying is just human nature is to not be honest and truthful and good all the time. That's just not human nature. So management, when they go to City Hall or their funding operation to get money to run the department, they're always talking about more police officers to make more arrests. That's their solution. And it's really naive. If you accept the premise for just a moment that we're all occasionally bad people and that we all should be in jail, what kind of life is that going to be? We're all going to be in prison. Then there won't be any crime anymore, which there's plenty of crime in prison. But just for the sake of this hypothetical, what kind of life is it if we're all living in prison? That wouldn't be much life at all. So these people, the officers on the street, want to be doing the right things. So what are the right things? There are about five or six core crimes that when I lay my head down on my pillow at night, I go, I'm worried about that criminal being in my neighborhood. Let's think about what they are. They're nighttime burglary, okay? They're rape, assault kind of things. Murder would be another one. Grand theft would be another one. Sexual assault of children. They're a group of just core crimes that we're really concerned about. And those used to be the only crimes that were enforced. We didn't have all these administrative crimes like driving on a suspended driver's license, you know, or failing to pay sales tax. You know, we didn't have those crimes. We just had the major crimes that make us scared at night when we're home in our houses and we want to enjoy life. So how can we help law enforcement focus on just those people? And really, it's pretty simple. It's not really complex. But they don't want to do it because they're so into making arrests and being able to explain to the media, hey, we arrested 60 felons last month. Okay. How many other more drugs? Well, 52. How does that help? So here's the answer to the question. And these are just a few of the ideas. You take a case of Apple iPhones, and you leave them on a loading dock somewhere. There is, by law, there is no privacy afforded people in stolen property. There's no right of privacy. So if I'm in a car and it's stolen, I don't have a right to not be searched. I don't have a right not to be stopped. And in this case, I don't have a right not to be arrested with a stolen car. So applying that legal theory to the iPhones, they're stolen. So you put a tracking device on them and you monitor everything that those iPhones do for the next 6 months. In that effort, you identify who the really bad guys are. I mean, that will absolutely happen because they will use those phones to conduct criminal activity. And because they have no right of privacy, you can lawfully listen to it, look at it, follow them, see where they are because they've got a stolen phone. So that's just a process of identifying who the really bad people are. For example, if you wanted to isolate out all the speeders in Jacksonville, just the speeders, the people who exceed the speed limit, fairly simple to do. All you've got to do is create a fine structure where it costs them $1,500, not $150 for a speeding ticket, and they seize the car for 3 weeks. You know, those are the things that change people's behavior. And another thing that I've talked to law enforcement about is just preventing them from issuing traffic citations altogether. And you can't believe the resistance, the apoplectic look that I get from officers when I make that suggestion. Because they think, because of what they've been taught by management, that one of their most critical functions is to stop cars and harass people. Harass is not the right word. They wouldn't use that word. But to make inquiry about the people in the car, the people in the area, and what they're doing. Why are they there? What are they doing? Well, a lot of people consider that harassment, but good law enforcement knows who are in your community, what they're doing, and why they're out at 3 in the morning. So there's a constant stress between these two views. But the effort needs to be recalibrated with identifying the really bad people in a community, and like a cancer, removing those cancers without killing the patient should be the primary objective. And I don't think it is today. People want the publicity of an arrest. And here's another thing. It just horrifies me. When I was a cop in Miami, I had to work for a sergeant named Jack Beckman. And Jack said, "Why are you all chasing these people? What you're putting at risk the driving public, the pedestrians, you're putting everybody at risk to chase one guy in a car that may be running from you simply because he doesn't have a license, not because he's a serial murderer, which is certainly most likely that he's just running from you because he doesn't want to go to jail, and he's not a serial murderer." And I read occasionally where police officers chasing individuals kill an entire family while chasing some guy who doesn't have a valid driver's license, or worse. Well, that's as bad as it gets, really. But they shoot people simply because they flee from them because they don't have a good license, and they kill those people. That's not good for the entire law enforcement community or for the community itself. Yet we still encourage officers to chase people in car chases. I mean, that's ridiculous. But if you were to suggest to all officers that they shouldn't be chasing people in cars, you know, realizing that it's a 3,800-pound projectile that they're riding in, you know, they just look at you like you've lost your mind. But those are policy issues. That's something that the sheriff or the police chief, somebody at a high level, has to say, "We're not doing that anymore. That's crazy. You're going to get yourself hurt. You're not advancing the interests of the public, and you're going to kill some innocent people. Why do that? Let him go. You'll catch another one or catch another one someday." But, of course, no one wants to hear that because they think that everybody who runs away from police officers is somebody who absolutely needs to be under the jailhouse.
It's He's since retired, but there was a radio talk show host out of the San Francisco Bay Area in a very large radio station, big broadcast station, most of the Western United States. And that was a thing that he was, I would say, ranting, because I kind of relate to that, about that very issue where officers would be chasing somebody through San Francisco at high speed. And it was just ludicrous when you would see the damage that would occur or could occur or the potentials. And it was, even if it was a murderer, it doesn't make any sense from this side, from the observer. You know, what are you doing? Why are you endangering more people by doing this? Because you're then forcing that person that you're chasing, you're making them drive even stupider. They're already driving stupid,
right.
And now you're like, what are you thinking?
Right.
You know,
it's
a bad issue.
But the sad thing about it is that it makes great TV.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it makes
ever since
great,
OJ.
When the helicopters follow him and he's narrowly missing, we all watch TV when OJ Simpson was doing the Bronco chase, you know, at 12 miles an hour. I mean, we are voyeurs. We love looking at other people doing things, not necessarily in a sexual context. We just like looking at other people. And so when people are running from the law enforcement people, we want to watch that. So it makes good TV,
yeah,
but it doesn't make good sense.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. I have an audience question, which is not exactly here, but it's a great question. Why does it seem that the police are targeting the underclass or the less, you know? Yeah, just I'll use the term underclass.
No.
That's really
an interesting question, but it's so simple when you think about it. Okay, remembering that police officers think that to solve a crime problem, what do? You put the criminals in jail. True. And remember,
mm-hmm,
the only way for an officer to put criminals in jail is to find them, right? And the simplest way for them to find them is to make car stops. Just accept that for a minute as the truth, okay? Where do most crimes occur? In the inner city, right? No question about that. In the poor areas, that's where all the drama is. That's where things go south, because people don't necessarily have good domestic management skills. So they're always fighting and raising hell. Or, you know, that's where the burglars occur, because that's where the burglars live. They don't live in, I mean, the burglars that, let me clarify that. The really worst criminals, they do live in big money houses because they're good at it. And they live in a world that's different, and most of it's white collar fraud. And that's what makes big money. But when we get to the lower criminals, we're talking about trespass. We're talking about burglary. We're talking about shoplifting, retail theft. We're talking about car theft. We're talking about stolen property. We're talking about assault and battery. All of those kind of things are occurring in a fairly condensed area. Anyone can take a map out and lay it over the higher crime areas, and you can see where they are. Well, what did the police administrators do? They go, well, we've got to put more police officers on the street. Go to the mayor, go to the funding group. They say, yes, right, we need more police officers. Because that's like, to them, it's a no-brainer, because they're not really very sophisticated when it comes to solving community problems. That's why we have this massive government that we shouldn't have. But in either event, they say, all right, more police officers. Where would you deploy those police officers if you were the sheriff and you got new police officers? You're going to deploy them in the high crime areas, right? So now you have a bunch of testosterone-driven, mostly, maybe some estrogen-driven, but testosterone-driven guys who are 18 to 28 in, or 21 to, I actually worked with the youngest police officer in the country when I was a cop in Miami back in 74. He hit the street at 18 years and 6 months. So
wow.
18 to 28, they are on the street, okay? They're full of testosterone. They love a game sport because they're on a squad that's competing with other squads for the most arrests in the community during their operational shift, okay? So they're now in the high crime area. That's where the underclass lives. And so absolutely you're going to have more arrests in the under area. There's just no question about it. It can't be anything but that. But that is the misdirection the police chiefs have when it comes to enforcing. And the thought process that officers should be promoted from street officer to detective based on the number, sheer number of arrests that they make, is that doesn't make good sense. Simply because you make a lot of arrests doesn't mean that you're a good detective. I mean, detectives are thinking people, not necessarily people who arrest everybody for any little infraction at a traffic stop. There's no nexus between those two skill sets, but it is the skill set that's been used traditionally in law enforcement for the 60 years that I've been involved in it. And I will tell you, that's the gauge that's used, the predominant gauge. If you can't arrest people, how the hell could you be a detective? But the bottom line is you have more crime in the inner city. You have more police officers enforce the law. You got more young police officers that are energized and believe because their bosses have told them that the only way to solve crime is to arrest as many people as you can. And candidly, the directors don't say we're trying to solve law enforcement. I mean, crime. They don't say that to the young officers. They simply say these words: you're competing against these other squads. I want to see you come out on top. You need to arrest more people, Squad A. And Squad B goes, the hell, they're not going to arrest more people than us. So you've got this driven factor of guys in cars with guns and radios and a badge which says I can arrest people who are engaged in criminal activity. That's the mindset that you have to alter in order to reduce these arrests.
Well, when we have this audience member is asking this question, and this fits right here so perfectly. We hear about quotas with police, and from what you're saying, this seems like a self-winding answer. I mean, is that true? We hear about quotas, and everything that you've said kind of directs us toward, like, yeah, that happens. Is that really true about quotas?
Well, no, but there's no quota. There's no list that comes out. In fact, in Florida, not more than 3 months ago, somebody in the State Highway Patrol, which is the Florida Highway Patrol here, said, I want you to write at least 2 tickets an hour, whatever the number was, right? Oh, you should have heard, you know, the wails and gnashing of teeth from people who wanted a piece of his head, you know? How would you say that? That's a quota, right? No. It's much worse than that. Imagine you're 22 years old, you're buff because you work out all the time in the police gym, and you're with a dozen other guys who are just like you. And one of the things you talk about every day is who you arrested. That makes you, it's like scoring points on a football team or a soccer match score. You're the hero if you arrest the bad guys, right? I frequently led the district in arrests. And I was like the hero. Well, that's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. So it's worse than a quota. It's as many fish as you can pull into the boat and unhook. I don't care what size they are. Just get them in the boat. I don't care if they're little or big. It's the sheer number. If you can bring in 50 into your boat and the other guy only brings in 7, you're the hero. No question about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you remember playing on sports teams when you were young? It's the same incentive. There's just no difference. And when we looked at one another, when we shifted on and off, you know, we would often say to the other team, did you all guys do as poorly last week as I think you did? And they would say, what are you talking about? There's this basic interaction, male-to-male interaction, and I realize there are female officers, and I'm not trying to disrespect them at all. I'm just trying to make a point here that there's a lot of energy that goes into these individual squads. And the squad as a sergeant. And the sergeant's like the cheerleader to encourage his or her squad to arrest more people than the other people. That's the criteria. So it's much worse, much, much, much worse than a quota. A quota says you can stop at 10. But a team sport like this, you know, that's the team that can't score any points, and the other team keeps running until they're 60-0, and everybody maligns them and says, you all shouldn't do that. Well, in law enforcement, if you could get 70-0, you'd try to do that.
Wow. I'm going to ask a question that I know that's going to make us – we're already a few minutes over, but what you talk about is so important. Is there – how much is the influence of some of the actions that are taken having to do with things like forfeiture? You know, where the police departments seize something, a boatload of money. Let's say they're in a state like California when – before cannabis became semi-legal, and pretty soon it's going to be recreationally legal. I know people who were in those businesses who would be stopped by an officer in the country, you know, up somewhere in the sticks. They'd be stopped. The officer would give them, you know, static. They might seize their pot and their cash. And they... Well, that was an illegal act, so they just got to do that. Let me change that. You have somebody who's transporting goods for somebody with an airplane. I know people have had their airplane seized, and they might get their airplane back, but it might take 2 or 3 years. I mean, is forfeiture a motivator for police departments? The ability to accrue funds or weaponry or whatever it is?
There's no question that it is. And I will tell you that within the tri-state area around Florida, I will tell you that there are special groups. They are called the HIDA team, H-I-D-I, High Intensity Drug Enforcement. Okay, that's what they do. In the HIDA teams, they only stop people because they meet the profile of drug traffickers going up 95, okay, I-95, which goes all the way from Miami to New York and further, but that's what they do. They look for those people. And then they do an interesting thing that gets into this new device where they can employ it to monitor your cell phone calls, your texting. And they identify and isolate out the people who are trafficking drugs. And they stop them. And one of the questions that they ask now is not, when I stop your car, do I ask, do you have any guns or narcotics in your car, which is what I used to ask as a cop in Miami. Now what I ask is, do you have any guns, narcotics, or money in the car with you?
Mm-hmm.
If you say, no, I don't have any money, then they immediately call the drug interdiction dog, and guess what's on most $100 bills? Cocaine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in aggregate,
mm-hmm.
the dog can sometimes smell that cocaine. So the dog sniffs out and finds the money. You've told the officer you don't have any money. So then the officer seizes the money. And we're talking about significant amounts of cash. I've had cases, $150,000 taken. And I've had clients who said, that's not my money. And what we used to do is, or law enforcement used to do now, is they would give the guy a Polaroid of the money being seized by the officer in the county where it was seized. Do you know why they did that? They did that so that the guy didn't get to New York and get killed by the transporters because they think he stole the money. So that's hence a Polaroid photograph. So, yes, they do stop cars. They seize money. The last one I handled, which was a 1983 action, which was civil rights violations, what it was. And this guy was stopped. His money was seized. And he actually went back to get the money. When he went back to get the money, they tried to arrest him on some impertinent charges that weren't true. They didn't want to give him his $36,000 back. So we sued him in federal district court. It took 7 years for us to get his money back.
Wow.
And so, yeah, by the time 7 years goes by, the $36,000 isn't as important as it once was. So you're right. The government loves to seize money, and they will seize just the money if you can't explain where it came from. So that's another big issue. When they stop you today and they ask, do you have any guns, narcotics, or money in the car with you, you say, officer, I was late when you stopped me. I'm later still now. Can I go? So you're not answering any of those questions. You're not saying, I don't have any guns. I don't have any narcotics. I don't have any money in my car. You're not answering those questions. Because if you answer those questions and then they find them, it gives them a reason to seize your gun. Clearly, they're going to take the contraband, the narcotics, but they can also now seize your money. And if you don't come back to get it, and candidly, what we just had happen in a case is they seized $48,000, and then the federal government took the money. So we were able to demonstrate that the seizure was unlawful, but the federal government had now seized it. So now we've got to bring another case against the federal government in order to get the $48,000 back. So they're just sort of these oddities, and the Supreme Court is looking at the propriety of people just seizing stuff because you have it. And we're not under any obligation to tell law enforcement that you have narcotics. That's an admission against your interest. It's a Fifth Amendment privilege, right? And certainly a search, if you authorize a search when you shouldn't, which you should never, ever do. The officer, simply because she's talking to you, doesn't mean you've got to answer everything she asks you. You can give her your license, and I recommend candidly you put your license, your insurance card, and your registration above your visor. You say, officer, my registration, insurance, and driver's license are up there. Can I hand them to you? She says, yes. You hand them to her, and you just sit there. Just sit there. And it's so hard for people not to run their mouth. But you just sit there, wait for the officer to tell you what the violation is, and don't answer the question, do you know why I'm stopping you? You just look at them. You just look at them. My wife occasionally does that to me when I do something stupid. You just look at them. So you got to learn that technique. You just look at them like you're just mystified. And let them answer the question so they don't write on the ticket, driver acknowledges they were speeding, right? Don't do that. You know? So police officers, just because they ask you a question beyond the driver's license, registration, insurance, if they ask you, where were you going? You just look at them. I'm sorry. Are you going to issue me a ticket? I mean, you want to avoid being snooty with the officer, okay? So use your manners in a car stop. Be pleasant. Don't allow them. Don't authorize a search. It's never in your best interest to do so.
If you admit that you did something wrong, do you know you were speeding? Well, yes, officer. Does that give them the right then to abuse you because you've admitted to a crime?
No, it does not, but they will typically. But I will tell you, Sherry, it's just really simple to look at them and say, or you could say, I'm sorry, officer, why did you stop me? Right? You could ask that question. You were speeding, and don't go, oh, no, I wasn't. This is not the place for that dog fight. You can have that dog fight in court, but you don't want to have that dog fight in the street, okay? Because the officer's always in charge on the streets. They got a taser, they got probably pepper gas, and they've damn sure got a gun and probably enough ammunition in the trunk along with a shotgun. Don't give them a hard time. Be pleasant, take the ticket, and then call a lawyer and see if you can get out of the ticket. But never agree to a search. That's just un-American, candidly. And a lot of I used to do it all the time in Miami, and people don't understand their right to refuse a search, or better yet, from my perspective, simply not answer the question. Officer, I'm late. I'm headed to my mom. She'll worry. Can I go? No, I'm going to issue you a citation. Yes, sir. That's all.
Here's a question from our audience, I think so important that we ought not to close the show. That the TSA, they've got roadblocks and stuff set up. How legal is that as opposed to a cop?
You know, there's a real fight about that. The U.S. Customs has interstate checkpoints, particularly around Texas and areas close to the border, and they will stop you. You don't have to agree to a search, but I will tell you that if they find illegal substances and you've agreed to a search, you're going to jail. And typically they're only looking for people who are trying to come into the country illegally. People are generally big. But no, you shouldn't agree to a search under circumstances like that either. And I will tell you an interesting story about a sheriff. I knew some of the actual sheriffs in Florida. One of his fellow's name was John Rutherford. He is now in the House of Representatives, as it happened. TSA wrote him a letter saying that he was going to, TSA, or at the time Customs, and they've all been put together into one organization under Homeland Security now, so it's probably better to talk about them as Homeland Security. But Homeland Security was going to start stopping people in Jacksonville with a Homeland Security just for checks, right? And John Rutherford, who I know pretty well, said, okay, you do that, and I will put a police officer with every one of those Homeland Security guys, and I will tell the police officers to tell the driver that they're free to leave immediately. They don't have to stop. So there's a big fight about whether or not TSA, Homeland Security, should have any jurisdiction to manage traffic on the highways and to routinely just stop people as in a roadblock and say, let me see your driver's license. They don't have any authority to do that. But if you have a sheriff or a chief law enforcement officer who gets along with or wants to please Homeland Security, that's likely a coming problem. I mean, I think we're all concerned that there's an effort afoot to have federal law enforcement officers empowered to make traffic stops and do the same things law enforcement does in our individual communities today. And I think that's really dangerous. I don't look forward to those times at all.
Oh, that's such a show.
Is there anything that, I mean, to close, but this is important too. Is there anything that we can do as citizens to help stop this authority, other than just being stubborn when we get stopped? Any legislation?
Well, you know, it's sad, Sherry, but you called it exactly what most people would call it, being stubborn. But it isn't being stubborn. It's being aware of your rights as an American. We have certain rights, some of them inalienable, some of them granted, but we have certain rights. And one of those rights is to be let alone by government, to be let alone by government. And that was, oddly enough, back in the 50s, there was a view that the government ought to be able to monitor every telephone conversation, okay? And there were a series of cases in which that was ultimately outlawed, but it took some time. And there was a justice, and that justice of the Supreme Court brought things to the point where he said, our most important right is the right to be let alone by government. And today we are surrendering that right in the name of this perception of public safety, that the only way we can be safe is to surrender all of our freedoms. I don't believe that. I believe that we should each be responsible for our own. I'm a rugged individualist. I believe that people need to be responsible for themselves and protecting their family and those kind of things. One of the last things I'm going to do is call 911 when I got a problem. I'm going to try to sort it out myself. And if I can't, then I might consider calling 911. But too many people today, the first thing they do, their knee-jerk when they're in a dispute with somebody or a situation, is to dial 911 and leave the line open so 911 records everything that goes on while they're calling for police assistance. I love police officers, most of them, but I don't want them around my house. I don't want them interfering with my life. I don't want somebody else telling me what I can and can't do. I got a wife, that's enough. She will be happy to tell me what I can and can't do. So, but getting government involved, it has become so progressive is the word, but they just overreach wherever they can to garner a little bit more control over our existence. And we are letting it do that. So the answer to your question, Sherry, is, yeah, you got to stand your ground against this overreaching by law enforcement. And getting other people, the government particularly, involved in your life is not an answer. It's just a complication for the problem, in my view.
I'm so looking forward to our next show where you talk about your book. And you really, once this is done, we really get to have that whole conversation.
Absolutely.
Of
would love
taking back our
it.
Power. You know, I think it's a slippery slope that we're on with the invasion of the DHS and the feds, thinking that they, you know, will have power in all of the states. And there should be but not the extent they have now is mind-numbing to me.
When I was an FBI agent, there were 4,500 FBI agents. That was it. That was the only federal investigative agency. Now, with Homeland Security, there are tens of thousands, almost, in my view, overnight. You don't need that many enforcement officers. Yet we surrendered with TSA, and I understand that with the transport people. I understand that. Because I don't want to be on an airplane with a bomb. I don't want that. And although that was hard to do, I can understand why we need to protect people on aircraft. But expanding it beyond that, there are arenas which we should talk about sometime that Homeland Security is into now that you can't even fathom why they're into it. It just blows my mind. I go, what? Why are they doing that? And the answer is because there's a federal crime that deals with that specific issue, and they're the ones who investigate it.
Do you have a topic for the new book yet or a title that we can look for?
You know, I don't have. Part of it is just regaining control of our existence, looking at law enforcement and how it is that they do things and why they're doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. We are compounding the problem in our communities of these multiple arrests. You have families that everybody in the family's been arrested, and you've got to know that that family and the friends of that family, which they will have friends, hate law enforcement. So we're in a position now where many people in America hate law enforcement, and it's because for decades, they've been just harassed and arrested for the most minor things. Not that some of them didn't deserve to be arrested, but you've created an underclass that just doesn't trust law enforcement. And that will never work toward solving crime, because the most important aspect of solving crime is informants. It's people telling you that person over there did this and I saw him bury the gun over there. And if you don't have that, then you have the problems that we're seeing today. So it's a hard effort at trying to educate people to change up for the benefit of everybody, not only the police officers and the administrators, but you realize in Jacksonville, 54 to 56% of all the revenue gathered through taxes goes to public safety. That's crazy. That means
wow.
We can't have all of the neat things that good communities can have that are good life-giving, life-affirming programs and places to go do things and music and art and all of those things. No, we're paying for police officers in cars to ride around and put people in jail. That's crazy. How can we fix that? And that's the subject matter of that particular book.
I'm really looking forward to that book. I hope you're I don't know when you take time off to do that, but get that written. I can't wait to have you back.
I work on it daily. And listen, thank
I
you
bet.
All for having me on so much, Sherry. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you,
you
so much.
You are welcome back anytime.
And this is for people listening who aren't watching chat and stuff. It's DaleCarsonLaw.com, and I put that in chat. And we'll, I believe it's on the show notes at SoundHealthOptions.com under the Blog Talk Radio tab. And thank you, Dale. It's an adventure, as always. It's a great adventure. Everybody have a great rest of the week. And go ahead, Sherry.
For those listening, please send information about this show to everyone on your list. Where can they find the link?
You can find this link again at soundhealthoptions.com. Click on the blog, on the radio tab, and then click on the Blog Talk Radio archive player, and you'll find the replay there about 15 to 20 minutes after the show is over. And you can also go to iTunes or any of your podcast players of choice and search for Sherry Edwards. And the podcast aggregators take a little longer, sometimes up to half a day, to get the feed in there, but it's usually about an hour or so. All right, everybody.
Richard,
thank
Sherry,
you again,
take
Dale.
Care.
You
no,
too.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Dale. Keep
Here.
Up the good work. Thank you. I wish
Thank
you were in
you.
My state. All right, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Later.